Hey, everybody. Welcome today to our conversation about fast fashion. I am joined with two new friends, Haley and
Joe Johnson. A radio name.
A radio name. So first, I'm going to ask Haley what her thoughts are on fast fashion and how she defines fast fashion.
Well, to give you a little bit of a backdrop on fast fashion, or at least my viewpoint on it, I've been selling vintage now for about 20 years. Before that, I was thrifting, garage sailing, doing all the things. So in that time period, I went to fashion school. I also used to work with wardrobe in the movie industry. So seeing all the different arenas that fast fashion touches, it's been an interesting viewpoint of mine and something I like to look at and study and research. I would define fast fashion as anything that creates an excess amount of clothing, and the usage behind it is really intended to be used maybe a handful of times, if that. Maybe it's for one event. And a lot of the garments that we're having produced in the world at this point are honestly produced that way. We wear it for a season, and they're meant to be thrown away or just honestly fall apart on our bodies. And that's actually a lot of what we're getting in most major malls and online and Amazon. And obviously the big one that we probably want to talk about a little bit more is Shein, which is one of the bigger ones that is kind of consuming up a major demographic of what's being purchased, especially among Gen X. They're really into that.
Yeah, thank you for that. So Joe is our ad man out today.
I'm learning.
He's learning about fast fashion. He doesn't know anything about fast fashion. So I'm going to ask Joe, what is your favorite clothing article that you put on and you just feel like the man? Like, it just makes you feel good. So what's your favorite clothing article?
Well, you know what's funny? I saw a comedian the other day, and he says when it comes to men, they reach a certain age where they think they look good and they, you know, the way they dress. And then as they get older, they think about themselves being young and handsome in that clothing, and they continue to wear that style of clothing the rest of their lives. The generation before me, you know, they had a certain look, and they still wear that certain fashion today. And for me, I feel like I peaked in the 80s, maybe early 90s. And so I used to love wearing, like, long sleeve pullovers, occasionally like a turtleneck. I love pastels and bright colors. Sometimes to reflect my mood, I might wear black or, you know, something like that. But normally, I think I look my best when I'm wearing fashion that reminds me when I was at my peak in the 80s and 90s, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, thanks for that. Go ahead.
Honestly, that's iconic, and you should stick with that. I love that. That's a great way. That's a great frame of reference for yourself.
You know, for me, I learned about fast fashion while I was doing research. I look at gender representations in East and South Asian media. So that means I've watched a ton of K-pop and C-pop and Thai pop and Thailand pop and television shows from from India, which is in South Asia. And I look at how fashion is used in these productions, and it really came to my mind how much luxury is there, how much luxury is pushed in characters that would never be able to afford something. So I got really curious about this term fast fashion, and then I found out that fibers are basically the third largest waste item in the world. And that when I was a girl, there were five fashion seasons: fall, winter, spring, and summer, and travel. So basically an access to travel clothes, clothes, beach wear, like, you know, year round. Now there are over 22. And so just like Haley said, clothes at your favorite stores like TJ Maxx or Shein, which is spelled S-H-I-E-N, and is a huge, it's Chinese, it's a huge Chinese company. Not only did these clothes disappear after a few wears, you know, maybe you notice you bought this really cool sweater and you washed it and it instantly became nubby. If you're using like real fibers, natural fibers like wool, silk, or cotton, that doesn't happen. But polyester is basically, it is plastic. It is refined plastic to a fiber. And so all of the polyester versions are they don't break down. It's plastic. So you have plastic bottles and plastic containers and plastic chip bags, but then you also have basically plastic clothing. And so these things aren't breaking down, and they're basically clogging the waterways and the airways and the ways of our world.
I guess that kind of shows, that illustrates the importance of resale shops. So, you know, if the clothes is still in relatively good condition, you should donate it to someone who's going to resell it, as opposed to just bagging it up, throw it in the garbage.
Yeah. So you want to talk a little bit about that, Haley?
Yeah, absolutely. I that has been one of my like great sources of fascination and study, honestly, the last probably 10 or 15 years. As somebody who sources vintage, and I go all around the U.S., not just thrifting as a lot of people think I do, I actually find very little true vintage in the actual thrift stores, because the amount of fast fashion items that we have is truly like remarkable. It's actually devastating how much is being produced and how normal that is for an industry that pollutes as much as it does. So yeah, it's interesting to talk to this, have this conversation with people, like how do you go about your secondhand items that are in reasonably good condition? And there's a lot of wishful donation that happens when people think, oh, hey, these baby clothes are going to, you know, be great for a friend, but they have all these, you know, stains on it. Those aren't the kind of pieces that you obviously want to go donate. But I'm talking about things that are in relatively good condition. Maybe they have a little bit of life behind them. They look good. They should definitely be considered go to a place of either a donation place that would accept them. But I'm actually at the point now where I hate to call out certain organizations, but there's some organizations that are very transparent about how they take in their donations. You would be surprised. Some of the normal places that we go to, and you can probably think of two, one that we would normally go to as a place for donations. Those places, a lot of them, those things that you're donating to don't even end up in the stores. They don't even end up funding a lot of the things that you think they are funding. Mm-hmm. And a majority of them actually just end up in landfills or incinerators, which I have a very difficult time. So I've gotten to the point where I actually now donate to either like children or women's shelters. Yeah. I ask friends if this is something that they would like. I put it up on Facebook Marketplace, or just say, hey, I have this available. If anyone's interested, they can come by and grab it, because at least it's going to somebody who can then possibly assess it and use it, but it's not going so quickly into another landfill. At one point, we were taking some of these things that were not usable and using them as rags for insulation in housing and walls, but that's not happening, and every organization is so drastically different that the lack of transparency and also the other person that people they have to hire to kind of make those decisions aren't really being fully equipped or educated, or honestly, there's really not a lot of policies, which again drives me crazy.
Yeah. So. You know, one thing too is when we say landfills, we need to clarify that those aren't landfills here in Michigan. That a lot of this fiber and these clothes are baled up in bales, you know, half the size of our room here, and they're shipped to developing countries to deal with. And they're just dropped off. And so you can actually go in and see cities in different countries within the African continent where it's just clothing everywhere. They're baled and just dumped, and they're just left for people to deal with. And they don't have the infrastructure or the resources to deal with this massive amount of fiber that's coming into their countries.
You know, everyone thinks they have treasures in their attic and their basement. Is there any money to be made from vintage clothing? You know, retail stores that sell vintage clothing, if someone, let's say they find stuff that belonged to their mother or their grandmother in a trunk in an attic, is there any value there?
Absolutely. And if you're having a hard time with that, you can actually contact estate sale companies, who are typically people who come in and assess. They actually, it's a little bit interesting even how estate sales determine if they're going to take your, I mean, this is a house. Let's just say your mother or your grandparents passed away and you're trying to get this house as quickly on the market because it's a part of, you know, how you're working with your siblings or whatever the whole situation goes. A lot of times people aren't really looking at what's happening inside of those rooms, but what's inside of those rooms is actually one very interesting to you. You should really have a particular person who's going to go through and assess the value. But if you come across like an attic or a certain room or whatever it is, a few boxes, you can definitely go to estate sales. There are even consignment shops where you can bring in things too, like Plato's Closet, Buffalo Exchange, if you're on the west coast of the country. There's some randomly, but not as close. I think the closest one is in Chicago. These people can definitely help you get an idea. There's smaller vintage boutiques in Royal Oak and other areas that you can go to, but there's a lot of consignment shops, which is what I would look for, is consignment shops in particular, to come in and assess. And what one person assesses, and this is bringing me back to the whole thing about value and treasure over trash and how we perceive value or value in the things that we have around us and so easily discard, what one person says is valuable is going to be very different from another person. So if you're like looking, I would, you know, to see if there's something here, you can do a quick search on Google, eBay, any of those websites would give you an indicator if that special little porcelain collection that your, you know, your mother had is worth of any value. But you can definitely also go to a few different people or places to check and see. And that should actually be something that people explore more often, is just why it was that people held on to this and what the value could be for that.
Yeah, and I think that's great. When we're talking about value, I think it's important, too, as part of the conversation with fast fashion, to look at the human value behind who's producing these clothes. We have this massive amount of waste, but what's life like for those behind the scenes that are making it? In a lot of developing countries, people are not paid a living wage. They're not even paid anything near a living wage of what we would consider a living wage in the United States. There's no health insurance. There is no money that's coming home. A lot of people are paid by the article that they make, and it's pennies on the article that they make. And there are not resources. There's not enough money for an infrastructure for childcare. And a lot of times there's corruption within these whole, entities of these business organizations and the whole field of those that are making fast fashion. In 2013, there was a factory in Bangladesh that 3/4 high, people were locked in. I mean, it was like the early centuries of this country and the Industrial Revolution, like all these other countries are going through similar things. So you have women, predominantly women, in poverty, in horrible poverty in these developing countries without education or resources. And their children, a lot of times, their young children are with them because there's not this access to childcare. You take care of your own children. And the building actually collapsed. And over 1,300 people were just smashed to death, just killed. And it was just outrageous. I mean, this whole experience.
Yeah.
I think that was the one that was connected to H&M specifically.
Yes.
And it was a huge, I mean, it was horrible it happened, but it brought a lot of light into what, you know, where are we sourcing these things? Where do they come from? And another one is a group of people in China that are being, I guess, targeted for their religious beliefs, and they're being held in these kind of like camps and doing the cotton picking. And I forgot the name of what this, it was supposed to be like a technology side of how we could look through our supplier chain and see where things were being sourced along the line.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with it was there's so much room for error and so much chances to have that information like edited down. So you didn't see that it was coming from these essentially prison camps,
right,
where people were being targeted off of their religious beliefs and being asked to pick the cotton. So that's Abercrombie and Fitch.
Yep.
A lot of these big, you know, if you were to look at it, and that's something that I think about a lot today. If I'm buying any type of cotton product and it's coming from and it's being produced in China, I'm wondering if it's, you know, or speculating like, where is it being sourced from on that far end of it?
Yeah.
And is there a possibility that somebody who's being, you know, locked in these camps, was he that person a part of that thing? I mean, there's a power in numbers and there's also power in your dollars. So I very much believe in voting wisely with that and going in all cases to support small and local. I mean, in general, small, local.
And that's a great point, too, because one of the things I've looked at are who are designers here in Michigan, and can I delay my own gratification? Say I want a new coat. Right. Or I want a new scarf. For new scarf, I actually asked my mother, Mom, for Christmas, I want a scarf. Will you make me one? And I, as an artist, do so many things, including sewing, but I don't knit or crochet. So I put my order in with Nancy and she made me this beautiful red scarf. Right. And I went to a local company or shop in her town in North Carolina, picked out the yarn. It's wool and cotton blend. So I have these natural fibers. And then my mom made it for me. You know, things like that of connecting with local artisans and requesting help with these things. You know, I want to take a pattern making class. I want to learn how to pattern make so I can make things for myself. And it takes time and it takes sacrifice and it takes a shift of my thinking. You know, it's I think we have to be more engaged and really kind of plan. A lot of times I remember when I was growing up that people did shopping therapy. Like they would walk around and just shop to feel good. That's a marketing tactic to get you into the store, to get you to buy their things. You know, for me now, I still like to walk around places like TJ Maxx, but my husband has been taught by me and we're flipping those tags and we're looking at where was it made and what is it made out of. And if it's made out of polyester, I'm not going to buy it anymore. It has to be over 90% natural fibers. And guess what? I don't find things like that in these stores. So I do shop secondhand and I still flip the tag and look, you know, what who made it and like what the content is. But I also have started looking at what can I make for myself and what can I hack, right? Like, because, you know, I like to hack things and I do that. You know, with jeans, I made a really cool jacket because I found out that it takes 85 gallons of water to make one pair of jeans. Mm. And you think of how many jeans there are in secondhand stores, how many jeans people have. Like, it's like a staple in pretty much fashion diet, right, is to have multiple pairs of jeans. But the dyes that are made for those jeans run off somewhere. And people live where that runoff is. So then you've got health issues. It goes back to the quality of life. It goes back to how we're treating the people that are making our clothes. It's absolutely horrific.
But I mean, in a large scale too, when you look at that, it's not just even localized to where the country of origin is. I mean, it all comes back
to
you.
It is a supply chain.
But we're all connected. I mean, things that are going on in other areas, eventually it's going to have implications on the overall quality.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there can't be a disconnect between that. And it's super unfortunate. But like, luckily, I feel like with the younger generation, I do feel like they place more importance on transparency. At the same time, I've never seen a group also love Shein as much as they do, which is so
very oxymoronic,
isn't it? But they like love the transparency. And I love that, too. I'm like I'm above that, like in terms of age. But I also think like, man, they get it. They're demanding that they see more transparency in companies. Mm-hmm. They're demanding to know what's happening in behind the scenes. They don't like the disconnect. They don't like the smoke and mirrors. Like, oh, this is what they want to see what happens at a company, big, you know, medium or small, behind, you know, everything, all those glossy images that we're used to seeing. So I think there's a lot of great things happening. I'm just wondering why are we still kind of doing, because before Shein, it was H&M, Zara. Yep. I mean, there's Forever 21, you know, all those
big companies, they're all fast fashion and they make their clothes to dissolve. Mm-hmm. They make their clothes to not be. I have a skirt that I bought when I was an undergraduate, which you can tell by my silver was a long time ago. And it was Ralph Lauren. It was a $250 skirt, which was like hugely expensive back then. I got it at clearance at Macy's for $50. I still have it. It still looks new. Mm-hmm. I dry clean it. I care for it. But it's 100% wool.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, even go just thinking about something you said with polyester. So there is a huge thing with 60s and 70s polyester pieces. Yeah. And I'm telling you from the archiving, I archive a lot of pieces and I archive prints as well into like a database.
Right.
And those polyester pieces from the 60s and 70s, those actual prints are being taken by top designers.
Yep.
They're not doing much to manipulate them. They're essentially using, because I've found the originals for the things that they've created recently within like the last few years, or sometimes I can even find it a little bit, you know, maybe 10 years. And they really don't do much to change that. And they put it back out on the runway. But those actual prints on the polyester, because polyester lives the way it does. So I've actually developed a little bit of a, you know, a soft place in my heart for polyester. Initially speaking, I was all about silks, you know, cotton, all the things, denim, but wool. And I will now source polyester 60s and 70s, possibly 80s, but for specifically for the prints. And the prints for a database that, you know, I personally am using, or hopefully other people will be able to use at some point. So
And that could be potentially something really great for designers.
Mm-hmm.
And then even for, you know, people that are out there, you know, the public, to just jump on your database, you know, if and when you get to the point where you allow others to have access. But they can look and see, is this really a vintage print? And if they get something today and somebody says, oh, this is a vintage print, well, they can double check with you to see if it really is or if somebody's trying to scam them. So,
yeah, it's fun finding what, you know, other people have dedicated basically huge departments for. Even for American Apparel, they used to go and send like maybe 5 or 6 people out to different thrift stores in the Los Angeles area. And they just basically ripped off a whole bunch of like the, you know, aerobic bodysuits that you would have found, you know, 10, 10 or 15, 20 years back, because that before TikTok, it was, we were going back in decades, like 10, 20 years. And that was kind of normal. Like if we did the 90s actually fed back to the 70s,
right.
A little bit of the 30s, 80s, it was the 40s, 50s. So, but now we're going through things like, I mean, the 90s were really, really popular. I was noticing my vintage buyers were buying that. Honestly, 10 years ago. And then when we were creeping up into the early thousands, I was not surprised. So the designers actually, there's a disconnect between like the high-end designers and people going back and trying to find some of these like silhouettes and cuts.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's so fun. We're in 2010s right now. So our cycles are getting really, really, really short.
Yep.
And part of us actually being driven by TikTok.
Yep.
And then all the aesthetics. So there's like Tomato Girl, there's Cozy Girl.
Yeah.
There's all these aesthetics that are coming faster and faster down the pipeline. And this is probably conspiracy theory, but you know, I think it's
our show. We can do what we
implied,
want.
I know, but TikTok and Shein are very closely linked in terms of how the government is utilizing those.
Right. So we've talked a lot, Haley and I, about fast fashion, and Joe has been patiently sitting here just absorbing all this new information. So I want to give you an opportunity to jump in and kind of share your thoughts about what you're learning about what we've talked about so far.
You know, you said something at the beginning of the podcast about the seasons, and there's fall, winter, spring, and summer, and travel season.
Mm-hmm.
And what you got me thinking about is when people travel, what do? They pose for selfies. They pose in front of landmarks. And they know they're going to be sharing those photos with friends and family. So I would imagine a lot more thought goes into packing your suitcase for a trip than just getting ready for work.
Yeah.
And recently I traveled to Dallas. Something that was on my bucket list was to visit Dealey Plaza in Dallas, where there's so much history there.
Right.
And being in the working in the video and film industry my whole life, there's a guy in Dallas named Abraham Zapruder. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the guy who recorded on film the Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood on this concrete block, this pedestal, to get a good vantage point. He captured the whole thing. And so I always thought, if I ever ended up at Dealey Plaza, I want to sort of pay my respects to Abraham Zapruder. And he was a guy who wore like a fedora. And you know those 60s style glasses that have like black on the top, silver on the bottom, you know, that sort of thing.
I have a pair.
Yeah, I have one. So I wanted to kind of emulate him. So as I was packing for my Dallas trip, I brought some vintage things with me, a short sleeve shirt that looked like something my dad might have wore a long time ago. And I got an exact duplicate of the camera that he had used to film the assassination. And so imagine I'm in Dealey Plaza with the glasses, the hat, the camera. That turned heads, and I would hand my phone to someone and say, can you get a picture of me standing on this block taking a picture? And I love that photo. I share it on social media because if I make it black and white, it looks like a photo that was taken in 1963 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so a lot more thought goes into that sort of thing when you travel, that you know you're going to be sharing these photos. You know a lot of people are going to see you. So you put a lot of thought into what you bring with you. And even if it's something as simple as a T-shirt with a graphic on it, I've posted pictures on Facebook and I've had people respond and go, did you plan that? That couldn't have been an accident. And I'm like, no, I put a lot of thought into this. So it's interesting when you said there's the travel season. Like people probably have things in their closet that they pull out, especially when they travel.
Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, one thing, too, about the connection that Haley made about between TikTok and some of these East Asian countries is the visuality of how we present ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that is seen in media constantly, you know, and those are very big social behaviors. In South Korea, for example, when one goes out and about, one is put together. My husband's a history professor and he loves baseball and he will look at old clips, Babe Ruth or like historical things, and they pan the crowd. And men are in suits with a hat and women are in dresses with a hat and possibly gloves. Like people dressed up to go to a baseball game.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people would go to certain functions, they'd be dressed up. Well, in like South Korea, when you leave the house 9 times out of 10, you know, for events, you are dressed up, and especially for women where it's become very oppressive and it has become a real issue. You know, your hair is done, your makeup is done. I mean, women, it's not unusual for them to spend 2 hours prepping with hair and makeup before they go out of the house to work or to college or to whatever event they're going to. And so, you know, when we look at the visuality and the visual presentation, these companies, you know, in East Asia that and their house there, they already know that there's a crowd and a market to push how you look, how you look, how you look. And so that kind of, like you said, it's this whole interconnectivity to really make women, because mostly women that are, you know, into fashion, and that's totally a generalization. There are a lot of men and other gender representations that are into fashion as well. But it's mostly women and those who identify as such that it really plays on their insecurities. It really plays on, you know, to be this or to appear as this, you need this clothing article. You need to look the certain way. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, we see that fast fashion isn't really about how people are paid to make the clothes, the care that they're given while they're working and making the clothes themselves, you know, the lifespan of the clothing, the waste of the clothing. But it really comes down to the individual and the perpetuation of the insecurity and the mental health and wellness of the individual that, you know, I won't be this kind of person. I won't be that kind of person unless I look a certain way when I'm out in public. And to look a certain way out in public, I need to have clothes from this company, this company, this company, or I lose my value as a human being. And the whole psychology behind that becomes so damaging to girls and women.
You know, pop culture has had an influence on the way people dress going back 100 years. And I always think about the story. There was a movie with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, black and white movie, huge hit, unexpected hit. And there was a scene where the characters put up a sheet. They had to share a room, and they put up a sheet. They called it the Walls of Jericho. And she slept on one side, and he was on the other side. And as they were having a conversation, he was undressing for bed, and he unbuttoned his shirt, Clark Gable did, and he revealed that he was not wearing a T-shirt, an undershirt, which was common at the time. Mm-hmm. And T-shirt sales plummeted from this one movie. If mm-hmm. Clark Gable doesn't wear an undershirt, I'm not wearing an undershirt.
Right.
JFK, he had a beautiful head of hair. He did not like wearing hats. And what happened? When you look at photos before JFK and after JFK, hats went out of fashion.
Right.
Because the president of the United States did not wear a hat. I'm not going to wear a hat. So
yeah.
People have always been kind of a slave to what they see other people do. You can call them influencers going all the way back to Clark Gable's days, but that's the way human nature is. We see others and go, hey, they look good. I want to look like that. And they emulate that.
Yeah. And I think too that, you know, stepping away from fast fashion takes a strong personality until you gain. And I think somebody who's not as strong can do it, but they have to kind of get permission to build their confidence and kind of own their own fashion sense and not be like a slave to fashion, for lack of a better phrase, and like just doing what fashion says, you know, to develop a sense of style versus following a fashion trend.
Right.
Like trends are what push the market. Trends, the next new thing. But having that sense of style lets you define how you want to look when you leave the house for whatever you're doing. And I look different when I do different things, right? Like today I look cute because I decided to, because I'm coming out in public and I meet new people, right? But some days I'm with Mr. Fernandez and I just like, I have on sweats, my hair's up in a knot. Sometimes I wear my dark glasses and I like run to Meijer and do whatever, you know? But I think owning our sense of style and being comfortable and defining that really helps build anyone's sense of security in themselves and confidence in themselves, but also it gives you a place to then teach your children. You know, my kids are my son lived with me while I was doing research at Penn State, and he knows a lot about fast fashion because he listened to me and got an earful. Do you know what, you know, this company does? Do you know what that company does? They're not transparent. Just like what Haley was talking about, is we'll get this whitewashing or this greenwashing on websites of companies who want us to believe, you know, the rhetoric that they're selling, that they're doing all these great things. But when it comes right down to it, when you want to see that supply chain from beginning to end and what's happening, it's really, really hard to see that because that transparency is not just there.
You know, you were talking about fashion trends and stuff. I find it fascinating that when you're looking at photographs, if you don't know what year a photograph was taken, you could guess pretty accurately by the fashions that appear in those photos. Mm-hmm. And you look at the 50s, you know, men wore ties and suits, hats. Women wore dresses and pearls. Then you go to the 60s, where there was kind of a rebellion and bell bottoms and, you know, showing midriffs and all this stuff. And then 70s, 60s kind of carried in the 70s, but now we got into the wide collars and the leisure suits, no ties, you know. Then 80s. My God, 80s had such a distinctive look with the hair that was
a mile high.
And I still have my members only jacket hanging in my closet at home.
Oh, my God.
And they all, each decade had such
a
distinctive.
Yeah, you want.
But I find that fascinating when you talk about trends, that each decade had a definitive trend. But it wasn't, I think, until we got into the 90s and 2000s where it gets a little harder to identify that period based on fashion, because I think a little bit of everything that came before it got incorporated into fashion of the 90s and 2000s.
I agree. Yeah. And when you talk to younger people, though, like specifically I'm saying like around whatever, anywhere between 16 to like 25, they find and like fast, they like kind of almost obsess over the early thousands, like the way they remember it and like what influenced them and the stores and the things. So their viewpoint of it is kind of singular to them and how like much less life they've had in some ways. So it feels iconic to them in some ways to think about what their mother was wearing when they were raising them, you know, 10 whatever years ago and all these other things and the shows they were watching. And I think that that's plays back into nostalgia being different for everyone, mm-hmm. Depending on their age, whatever they were used to culturally within their own family. But you brought up so many good points. There's something I wanted to say about just talking about how we looked at just like TikTok influencing or just whatever with the Southeast Asian countries. I think there's been some good things there. And then also at the same time, or possibly some bad things, but at the same time, some good things have happened. Like there's a website called lookbook.new. And there are people who live like in very remote like places, but because we have access to so many styles through the internet, they've mm-hmm. been able to achieve looks that make them feel so connected to a large group of people,
yeah.
or at the same time, maybe in a more niche way. And it's yeah. amazing. Like there's somebody who has these great makeup tutorials. She lives on an island in Canada that doesn't have a huge population, but her actual style and the way she puts her makeup together is so relevant, and it also is, you know, similarly affecting large other portions of the world population.
Right.
So there's some good things with this too.
Yeah.
On the other side of that being influenced so much on the psychological aspect of it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just want to thank both of you for joining me today. It's been so much fun.
Thanks for having us.
So today we're wrapping up our show. We've talked about fast fashion in the sense of global connections and what's our favorite item to wear and how fashion influences us. And we just want to thank you for being with us today and taking time out to listen to the show.